Some of these reasons, I think, have already been alluded to in earlier lectures. For example, the fortress destruction policy of the crown, instituted in the 1590s, which made it harder for aristocrats to hide out if they were going to rebel. Moreover, we've also pointed to the rising costs of battles and sieges, which made it really difficult for a series of nobles to compete with the monarchy in its unrivaled fiscal resources. Other factors have been pointed to, such as the sale of venal offices, which undermined the clientage networks of the nobles by making the crown the chief source of all patronage in France. Finally, I've drawn attention to the relocation of magnates from the provinces to Versailles and the consequent cultural and physical distancing of aristocrats from their former provincial roots and former provincial supporters. But it seems to me the question still remains, why would these former resistors to the crown have fallen for this? If the lectures thus far have shown anything, it's that the rise of the state is not a natural process. It needs an explanation. And ironically, a lot of the explanation comes down to money. Taxation was central to the relationship between the French crown and its subject population, and it seems to me that we're never going to understand Louis XIV's success without taking one last look at French taxation. The best-studied example of how taxation worked in actual practice in 17th-century France is the case of the southern province of Languedoc. This province was the subject of an extremely influential study published in 1985 by the historian William Bike. It should be said, Languedoc is, of course, not all of France. It's not representative of the entire country. No single province could be. But still, Languedoc was a very large province. It represented roughly a tenth of the area of the entire kingdom, and its population and contribution to the French monarchy's resources were roughly of the same order of magnitude. Moreover, and this is perhaps the more significant point, since the publication of William Bike's study in 1985, the tendency in historical scholarship has been to confirm his findings in other areas and to reinforce his general conclusions. So what did Bike find out when he looked at Languedoc in the 17th century? One of the first discoveries he made is that if we try to explain taxation in terms of arbitrary extraction by the crown, from a vanquished province and a rising burden of taxes, with the crown just deciding what it wants, dictating its financial receipts, this is a really misleading kind of picture for a number of reasons. In the first place, it really misstates the actual balance of power between the province on the one hand and the monarchy on the other. Moreover, there's the question of where does the money go? To just simply stress Louis's ability to order that certain taxes be raised ignores the question of distribution of tax revenues, and that turns out to be actually quite crucial. The later 17th century is actually better described in terms of two main trends. The first of these is a kind of shift in the way that taxes are imposed on the province of Languedoc, and the second main tendency is a kind of compromise, a kind of accommodation that's worked out between the monarchy and the elites of the province, which in practice amounted to a sharing of a steady and slowly growing body of provincial revenue. Let's look at the imposition of taxes itself. Between the 1630s and up to about the year 1661, taxation in Languedoc was characterized by fluctuation, by random, violent fluctuation in the amounts of taxes demanded from the province. Now, the driving force behind moving these fluctuations up and down was the war. Emergency levies to meet military costs on the one hand and to pay off the financiers from whom funds had been borrowed on the others. What is important about the crown's financial schemes during the 1630s and the 1640s in Languedoc is that almost all of these schemes, the buying of offices, the selling of offices, tax farming and so on and so forth, all of this had tended to be in the hands of Parisians, outsiders who actually spoke a completely different language. The province of Languedoc gets its name from the language. It's Languedoc means the language of Oc, the Languedoc, Oc being the old way in which people in southern France said yes. And northern France in Languedoc was called the Langue d'Oeil, the place where people say yes by saying oi or oui, as in modern France. So it was the language was so different that people often couldn't even understand each other. Now, during the 1650s, and especially during the 1660s, this situation in which finances are run by Parisians, at least finances in Languedoc, this situation changed in two important ways. First of all, the province itself, the provincial institutions, above all the estates, the representative assembly of Languedoc, regained legal control of the various financial agents. Between the year 1649 and the year 1656, the provincial estates of Languedoc were actually able to reacquire, by buying, the post of provincial treasurer, And moreover, this is the second main change, the province began to go into the credit business itself. And by the 1660s and the 1670s, the Parisian financiers, the outsiders who spoke that funny, strange language, had been displaced by local boys, by Languedocian financiers. Thus, there's a sense in which what has happened by the 1660s and 1670s is that the provincial elites in Languedoc are now being offered another relatively safe source of investment. It's a kind of deal in which the aristocracy and other members of the provincial elite loan their surplus capital, their surplus cash to the monarchy, and they collect the interest from the long-suffering peasantry. Now, it should be stressed that this is a deal which only benefits the elite. The common people were unable to invest in the fiscal apparatus of the absolute estate because they lack capital on a scale which would be of use to the crown. But nonetheless, brutal as it may sound, the common people didn't count as much. And at least for those who counted, the reshaping of crown finances in the 1660s and the 1670s meant that now the locals benefited from it rather than the outsiders from Paris.